The book of Job, beginning to read in the 15th chapter. The 15th chapter of the book of Job, Eliphaz, the first of the three friends who came to sympathize with Job in his agonies, speaks for the second time. We're going to look at chapters 15 to 17 this evening, but we'll read chapter 15 now. Then Eliphaz the Temanite, the area of the Edomites, Esau's people, Eliphaz the Temanite replied to Job, "Would a wise man answer with empty notions, or fill his belly with the hot east wind? Would he argue with useless words, with speeches that have no value? But you even undermine piety and hinder devotion to God. Your sin prompts your mouth. You adopt the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not mine. Your own lips testify against you. Are you the first man ever born? Were you brought forth before the hills? Did you listen in on God's counsel? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What insights do you have that we do not have? The gray-haired and the aged are on our side, men even older than your father. Are God's consolations not enough for you, words spoken gently to you? Why has your heart carried you away, and why do your eyes flash so that you vent your rage against God and pour out such words from your mouth? What is man that he could be pure, or one born of woman that he could be righteous? If God places no trust in his holy ones, the angels, if even the heavens are not pure in his eyes, how much less man, who is vile and corrupt, who drinks up evil like water? Listen to me, and I will explain to you. Let me tell you what I have seen, what wise men have declared, hiding nothing received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given when no alien passed among them. All his days the wicked man suffers torment. The ruthless through all the years stored up for him. Terrifying sounds fill his ears. When all seems well, marauders attack him. He despairs of escaping the darkness. He is marked for the sword. He wanders about, food for vultures. He knows the day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish fill him with terror. They overwhelm him like a king poised to attack, because he shakes his fist at God and vaunts himself against the Almighty, defiantly charging against him with a thick, strong shield. Though his face is covered with fat and his waist bulges with flesh, he will inhabit ruined towns and houses where no one lives, houses crumbling to rubble. He will no longer be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possessions spread over the land. He will not escape the darkness. A flame will wither his shoots, and the breath of God's mouth will carry him away. Let him not deceive himself by trusting what is worthless, for he will get nothing in return. Before his time, he will be paid in full, and his branches will not flourish. He will be like a vine stripped of its unripe grapes, like an olive tree shedding its blossoms. For the company of the godless will be barren, and fire will consume the tents of those who love bribes. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil. Their womb fashions deceit. May God bless to us his holy word and grant us light to understand this portion of it. Now let us read in God's holy word in the Old Testament in the book of Job, chapter 16 and 17. Job chapter 16, then Job replied to Eliphaz the second time, I have heard many things like these. Miserable comforters are you all. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you that you keep on arguing? I also could speak like you if you were in my place. I could make fine speeches against you and shake my head at you. But my mouth would encourage you. Comfort from my lips would bring you relief. Yet if I speak, my pain is not relieved, and if I refrain, it does not go away. And then he turns to God. Surely, O God, you have worn me out. You have devastated my entire household. You have bound me, and it has become a witness. My gauntness rises up and testifies against me. God assails me and tears me in his anger and gnashes his teeth at me. My opponent fastens on me his piercing eyes. Men open their mouths to jeer at me. They strike my cheek in scorn and unite together against me. God has turned me over to evil men. Well, you see, if we left out the word men there, that would be perfectly true, because this is exactly what the first two chapters of Job say. But more of that later. God has turned me over to evil men and thrown me into the clutches of the wicked. All was well with me, but he shattered me. He seized me by the neck and crushed me. He has made me his target. His archers surround me. Without pity, he pierces my kidneys and spills my gall on the ground. Again and again, he bursts upon me. He rushes at me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and buried my brow in the dust. My face is red with weeping. Deep shadows ring my eyes. Yet my hands, and here he defends himself, his blamelessness, which God has testified to in the first two chapters. Yet my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure. And then he cries out, O earth, do not cover my blood. May my cry never be laid to rest. Even now, he says, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercessor is my friend, he says, as my eyes pour out tears to God. On behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. These verses are not easy, 20 and 21. We'll look at them later on. Only a few years will pass before I go on the journey of no return. My spirit is broken, my days are cut short, the grave awaits me. Surely mockers surround me, my eyes must dwell on their hostility. Give me, O God, the pledge you demand. Which is an interesting statement. Give me the pledge you demand. Who else will put up security? You see how he's feeling after the mediator, the divine advocate, the Lord Jesus Christ. Who else will put up security for me? You have closed their minds to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. If a man denounces his friends for reward, the eyes of his children will fail. God has made me a byword to everyone, a man in whose face people spit. My eyes have grown dim with grief. My whole frame is but a shadow. Upright men are appalled at this. The innocent are aroused against the ungodly. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to their ways, and those with clean hands will grow stronger. What a mixture of statements we have here, and so much light, and yet so much darkness. But come on, all of you, try again. I will not find a wise man among you. My days have passed, my plans are shattered, and so are the desires of my heart. These men who are against him turn night into day. In the face of darkness, they say, light is near. But if the only home I hope for is the grave, if I spread out my bed in darkness, if I say to corruption, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who can see any hope for me? Will it go down to the gates of death? Will we descend together into the dust? Job, then, chapters 15 to 17. We hadn't much cause to approve of Eliphaz's first speech in chapters 4 and 5. Although you remember it began guardedly enough. But Eliphaz in his second speech surely wades in with both feet splashing furiously. Bildad, one of the other friends, had called Job a windbag. But here Eliphaz says Job has filled his belly with the hot east wind. Would a wise man, asks Eliphaz, act like that, with empty and useless words? Not only empty, but injurious, doing away with godly fear and hindering godly devotion. Ah, he says, it all comes from sin and craftiness, deeper than your mouth, but it is your mouth which condemns you. Nor does anyone need to condemn you, you do so yourself. Then Eliphaz turns to more rhetorical questions, as bitter and sarcastic as possible. Are you the first man to be born, brought forth before the hills? Were you present at the councils of eternity before the world began? Are you the one who, because of your primeval knowledge, can criticize God at source? Now, you may remember that the prophet Isaiah in chapter 40, that great chapter, asks questions like these, but not in this spirit. You remember, he asks, "Who has understood the Spirit of the Lord, or instructed him as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding?" And you see, it is in that chapter, Isaiah 40, that the prophet breaks out, "Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket, and as the fine dust on weighing scales." And then, from these colossal jibes, Eliphaz turns to comparison with himself and his friends. What do you know that we don't know? What are the insights that are not open to us? Not, says Eliphaz, that we boast on our own account, for we have the ancients on our side, gray-haired men older than your father, Job. And then in more moderate tones, this appeal. Are the consolations even of Almighty God not enough for you, Job? Even when they are offered gently. Gently, we say. Well, well, gently. And Eliphaz tries to contrast their gentleness with Job's rage. Job having absolutely no regard for the fact that the one man is, Eliphaz absolutely having no regard for the fact that the one man is sitting there in utter agony of body and mind, while the other three sit in the comfort of apparent health. Why has your heart carried you away, Job? Your eyes flashing with fire as you vent your rage upon the Almighty and pour such torrents of words from your mouth. And then a leading question on the primal nature of man. What is man? That he could be pure, and one born of woman that he could be righteous. If God places no trust in his holy ones, the angels, and if even the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man, vile and corrupt, who drinks up evil like water? Well, to begin with, Eliphaz, we might say, if all that's true, that condemns you too, doesn't it? But aren't you failing to make distinction there between angels and angels and man and man? There are holy angels whom God trusts implicitly and who speak only the words God gives them, as many passages in the scriptures testify. And despite the fallenness of the universe, for you see, as Paul tells the Romans in chapter 8, the natural creation did not fall of its own will. It had no will of its own, but it was dragged down by the sin of Lucifer and Adam. I say, despite the fallenness of the universe, man, who is after all the crown of God's creation beyond the angels, has been given a way to be righteous. Else what the Lord has already said about your victim Job, Eliphaz, could not be true. If no man can be righteous. But God has already said that Job was blameless and righteous. So it is possible for man to be righteous, Eliphaz. God has said it. And we see how right this is at the end of the book, of course, which we'll come to in due course, when Eliphaz in particular is singled out by the Lord for his anger, because he and his friends had not spoken what is right as my servant Job has. Then Eliphaz, having uttered these misunderstandings, goes on bombastically, verse 17, to say, listen to me and I will explain to you from my insight what wise men of old have declared without hiding anything that they have received from their fathers. And the word fathers there, according to Eliphas, is meant to mean the pure originators of his own Temanite tribe. Well, Teman, Edomites, pure, Esauites, pure. Did anything good ever come out of that wild land of Teman, Eliphas? And so he's back at the simplistic notion that all who suffer are under the judgmental hand of God. And you see, the thought that all who suffer are under the hand of God's judgment, that would have been true had not one called Christ come, who suffered on behalf of others. And they were sinners. And that being so, it is possible for us in Christ also to suffer for righteousness' sake. Job is suffering for righteousness' sake. But Eliphas can't see that. He rants on. All his days the wicked and ruthless man suffers torment, he says, as punishment is stored up against him throughout the years. Aye, Eliphas, be sure your sin will find you out, and that applies to you as well as to anyone else. And so Eliphas describes something of the afflictions of such wicked men, tilting, of course, at Job and imputing that he's suffering because he's a wicked man. What a nerve, what a cheek this man has. For even if Job were wicked, surely he could describe suffering far better than these three complacent creatures sitting in the comfort of their own health and welfare. He knows far more about suffering than they do. What a cheek there. But talk about rubbing salt into wounds. Think of the man saying this to an anguished fellow. Terrifying sounds will fill your ears, and when all seems well, marauders will attack you. You will despair of escaping the darkness, and you'll be marked for the sword. You wander about, food for vultures, with the very day of darkness itself looming ahead. And the man goes on, distress and anguish so fill the wicked with terror that it overwhelms them, as if a king were waiting to attack them. And all this, the man says, because Job's hand, he says, is lifted up against God, before whom he vaunts himself defiantly, charging against the Almighty. Futilely, of course, but charging against the Almighty with a thick, strong shield. What accusations. And look at this. Though his face is covered with fat, he says, and his waist bulges with flesh. Well, we feel like saying, you're not speaking of yourself, are you, Eliphas? But no, or Bildad, or Zophar, the nerve of it. So utterly inappropriate to poor Job, who very likely by now is quite emaciated. But he goes on, for all your self-indulgence, Job, you'll land in a place of desolation amongst rubble and ruin, with all your wealth gone and your possessions strewn across the countryside, as if there had been a raid and the plunderers dropped their booty as they fled. Then here's more about darkness and a flamethrower. That's pretty modern, isn't it? Oh, says Eliphas, It is the hot breath of the Almighty that is searing you and carrying you away. So you'd better not deceive yourself, thinking you will come to anything or gain anything. Long before your time, you will be paid in full for all your evil life, like a vine or olive stripped of its fruit and blossom. This, he says, is the lot of the godless, unutterable barrenness, as if a fire consumed the tents of the treacherous. For they simply conceive trouble and give birth to it. Their womb fashions deceit. Now, I must say that as I read these lines and typed some of these words, I said to myself, am I really seeing what is before my eyes in my book? I couldn't believe what he was saying after what God says about Job. And I don't think in all my readings of Job through the years I have ever taken in, as I do here, the dastardliness of this chapter. It beggars description. And before I even look at what poor Job is going to say in reply in chapter 16 and 17, I am sure that it is going to be, what he's going to say is going to be unbelievably mild in face of such a cowardly attack as that of Eliphaz is. Isn't Job remarkably gentle? Wouldn't you expect a blast after all that calumny on a good man suffering excruciatingly? But all he says is, I have heard many such things from you, miserable comforters. Will you never stop your long-winded arguments? Is there something wrong with you, Job asks, that you cannot stop? And then he says this, quite gently, if the tables were turned, do you not think that I could take your place and make fine speeches and shake my head at you? But I would never lower myself to your level. I would seek to encourage you in your distress and bring relief and comfort to bear on you from my lips. But it's not so with me now. Here I sit in agony, which is not relieved by speech. Not if I hold my tongue, does that make it go away and make it any easier? Nothing relieves my suffering. And then the dear man breaks out as if he suddenly roared up to high heaven, God, you have worn me out. You have devastated my entire household, and my gauntness testifies against me. And then he's soliloquizing. God has assailed me and is tearing me in his anger, gnashing his teeth at me. Then he calls God his opponent, who fastens his piercing eyes on him. What a plight the poor man, what awful torment he's in. But the worst of it is that men, supposedly good men, open their mouths and jeer at him. And he says, strike his cheek in scorn and unite together against him. And we ask ourselves, are these bystanders beyond the three friends? This will seem more incredible to you if you have read Job's description of his good works in earlier days. Job was the benefactor of the whole community in which he lived, possibly the whole nation amongst whom he lived. Just you have a look sometime at Job chapters 29 to 31 and see the kind of man this was before he was afflicted. And now, chapter 16, verse 11, he has a new facet of his trouble. God has turned him over to evil men, and has thrown him into the clutches of the wicked. Well, you know, as I remarked during the reading, that's a more than interesting remark. It sounds very ugly, doesn't it? God has turned me over to evil men and has thrown me into the clutches of the wicked. But put the evil one there in place of evil men. And that's exactly what God has done. He's told us so in chapters 1 and 2. It is true that God has done this, but by, well, must we say it again? I think we must, over and over and over again, as long as I have breath. It is true that God has done this, but by his sinless permissions of evil for his higher purposes. Know that, and you know almost all. And so true is this, that there must be times when we should say to God in our throes, O God, you and your higher purposes, I could be doing without them just to have a little peace. And the Lord would reply to us gently, dear child, you sound as if I sat in high heaven in all the comfort of my glorious throne and prescribed sufferings for my subjects for my own pleasure. No, he would say, do you not understand? And here's the heart of what I want to say. Do you not understand that not one particle, not one iota of human suffering, which God's chosen darling children are called upon to bear, but has passed through a father's heart and into his son's human body on the tree. No child of his is ever called upon to suffer one whit of pain or distress, but what it has been doctored, sanctified, prepared, its sting removed, sterilized by him. Did you not know that? No child of mine ever suffers unmedicated, untinctured suffering. Now, I don't know about you, but that, as I sat and typed, was a new thought to me. Certainly, it was a new thought in that unvarnished form. That no suffering of God's chosen children but has passed through the refining of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And you see, I think that since I see that more clearly than I ever did before, I think that is going to be forever a comfort to me. And also I hope to pass it on to those who will receive it to provide comfort and consolation for them too. Not only does he suffer with us, he has gone before and sterilized the suffering, so that it is for good and not evil. Oh, what a comfort! Even in agony you could lie down and put your head on the pillow and sleep peacefully with such a marvelous thought as that, couldn't you? But you see, Job is not done with his tirade against God. All was well with me, he says, bitterly, until you shattered me, seizing me by the neck and crushing me. I am your target, he says. Are you or your archers practicing on me? The mercilessness of it, he says, as my kidneys are pierced and my gall is spilt on the ground, is that in my agony, the Almighty rushes on me again and again like a tireless warrior, so that I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and bury my brow in the dust. My face is red with weeping. And when you think of that, and what this callous monster Eliphaz has just been saying about dear Job, it almost makes us weep so long after the event. Then this. Job moves from being aware of the shadows under his eyes. He moves from that to this defiant note of confession of his blamelessness. Yet, he says, my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure. But you may say, how can you say that, Job, when you have said such terrible things about God? How can you say that when you've said such terrible things about God? And the answer to that is because the terrible things he has said about God are all true, but not true of God, but of God's, to him, unknown enemy, Satan. They're all true. And that's the intriguing thing about this book. Yet men, scholars, have spent ages poring over the book of Job and giving it the most detailed linguistic scrutiny, and yet have done so from the point of view of not actually believing in a real live devil at all. They must have the same attitude to Job as these three friends who see him. They see Job as attacking their God, with no idea that the nearest Job can get to understanding is that God, this is the nearest that Job can get to understanding. He sees two gods, the God he knew before in his prosperity, and then this monster God, and he can't understand. Has God, is he a chameleon? The nearest Job can come to understanding of this mystery and phenomenon is that he thinks that God must have two faces, and not only two faces, but two natures. One as diametrically opposed to the other, as black as to white, and night as to day, and hell as to heaven. And when Job at last emits this most heart-rending cry, it is to try to move towards an understanding of the relationship of suffering man to holy God in terms of mediation. Is someone going to stand between us and help us? And the mediator, of course, that he feels after, and we shall see, God willing, in chapter 19, next Lord's Day, is the Christ, the mediator. He's feeling after him more and more unerringly. But Job must have been fearing something like annihilation, being blotted out and destroyed when he groaned, O earth, do not cover my blood. That's a bit like Abel's blood, you remember, crying from the ground for justice and retribution. And so he cried, may my cry never be laid to rest, And of course this shows an insight into the eternal justice of God, which cannot envisage in any possible world of God's making that ultimate justice should not be done and be seen to be done. The Westminster Confession of Faith not only speaks often of the glorious grace of Almighty God, but it speaks of his glorious justice. Glorious justice. And that, of course, involves punishment of the unrepentant wicked. Glorious justice. And so far from Job and his cause being annihilated, he says he sees his witness, that is the witness of his God-owned integrity. He sees his witness in heaven. Ah! Heaven, of course, is the great eternal clearing house. His advocate is there on high, and he sees that, and it's wonderful. Even if it's only a temporary gleam, he's seen it. Never forget it. Like a flash of lightning in which you see the whole scene in the midst of the darkest night. But there is some dubiety about the meaning of the first line of chapter 16, verse 20. As we read it in the New International Version, it says, "My intercessor is my friend." And that seems most appropriate, but it is doubtful if that is the true reading there. It is possible that the first line of verse 20, chapter 16, is set in contrast with the second line. And if so, it could read like this: "My friends are my scorners, but unto God mine eyes pour out tears." What do you think of that? At all events, verse 21 sums it all up. On behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. But the Good News Bible sorts that out beautifully. It makes Job say very clearly, "I want someone to plead with God for me as a man pleads for his friend." Well, that's clear enough, isn't it? And what is that that he's feeling after? But a mediator. Someone to come between God and him, and who will understand both points of view and try to clear things up. And you see, it is amazing that this ancient man, Job, so early in human history, senses so accurately the nature of the relationship God will establish with sinner man in order to have man as the crown of his creation in heaven. Job sees that so wonderfully clearly. But then should we be surprised that a man so highly commended by God, even in his almost unendurable throes and sufferings, that a man so highly commended by God should receive such authentic intimations? No. For he who lives closest to God will know him the best, won't he? And understand both God's will and God's ways the most. Surely that's true. Life wouldn't be worth living for Christians otherwise. The closer we live to God, the more we shall understand. But then, as usual, after these insights, the poor man slumps into near despair. And the fact that he mentions years surprises us, for we can hardly conceive of him enduring his present sufferings for years. But it seems to be the passing years he's referring to. And I think he sees his days as much shorter than years, for his spirit, he says, is broken, and the grave is waiting for him. And one reason for seeking an early grave would be the attitude of the people around him, which is surely one of the most shocking things about the story. added to all his other troubles, especially these three insufferable friends, was the hostility of the common people. Who would not want to die with such a complete package of troubles weighing him down at every level of his life? Life was not worth living to Job then. Everything and everyone seemed against him. And so he turned to God again, the God he doesn't understand, this dual personality God. Give me, he says, the pledge you demand. That's a kind of legal curiosity, isn't it? Give me. That belongs not to the court of justice, but to the throne of grace. Give me the pledge you demand. Driver and Gray, in their monumental commentary on Job, read this line: lay down, I pray thee, the pledge for me with thyself. Who else is there that will strike his hand with mine? That is, who else can I make a bargain with but God? So, you could almost hear Job saying, will the good God please stand forth and speak for me and present a pledge for me against his hostile counterpart, the monster God? Well, Job, if he doesn't, no one else will. We're sure of that. And that is the point. That's the point of the story. And one reason why it is important, perhaps even necessary, is that Job should be brought low so that he might know that there is no one else in the whole wide world to help him but the God he knew and yet feared had turned against him. So at chapter 17, verse 4, he discusses the uselessness of men to help. They have closed their minds to understanding. So he appeals to the Lord to prevent such creatures gloating over him and dealing treacherously with him. There's no limit to the mendacity of those who would be prepared to make a trade even of their best friends. And such seem to be the people around Job. That's the sort of people around him who have made his name a byword and who would think nothing of spitting in his face. Well, look at Lazarus at the rich man's gate. His only friends were the wild street dogs. And such a sorry state is enough to make Job's eyes, he says, grow dim with grief and his healthy body become a shadow, whether that means he is emaciated or grown thin as a skeleton is not clear. But there's a hint around this part of chapter 17. There's a hint that seems to suggest that there are some decent souls around. And Job says they are appalled. We suppose both they are appalled both at his sufferings and also at the horrible attitude of his so-called friends to his sufferings. And we wonder whether there had been some kind of altercation, some argument between his so-called friends, the three, and those around, few though they may have been, who had some compassion and care for the poor man. We don't know. And one also wonders why, if there were those who had genuine sympathy, why they did not seek to do something practical to help the man. Was there some embargo on them helping him and comforting him? If there was, Job makes it perfectly clear that the righteous who would have helped but were argued against were not moved in respect of him. And this seems to have given Job some consolation. There are those there who would have comforted him if they could have had the opportunity. Well, there are always some, be they as few as a mere remnant, who will stick to their ethical guns and grow stronger against opposition for the stand they take on a humanitarian issue. So Job seems to cry out to the generality of the populace, friend or foe, come on then, all of you, and let me see if there is a wise man amongst you. He doubts it. And as he makes another passing comment upon the shortness of his days, as he envisages them, he lets out a cry of hopelessness. His life seems almost at an end, and all his plans have been shattered with the desires of his heart. Poor Job. And the worst of it is this. What a revelation this is to him. That he was dwelling among a people, did he not see this in the days of his prosperity? For his good works were many in those days, and the respect that so many had for him would have suggested, you would have thought, that he dwelt in a community animated by the highest moral standards. But in his plight there is absolutely no sign of it, just a hint that a few felt for him, just a few. The rest? Bah! These men turn night into day and call darkness light. And that's what Isaiah said. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, Isaiah says in his 5th chapter, verse 20. Job almost suggests that although there would seem to be no hope for anyone who is about to make his long home in the grave and who has to make his bed there so that he can almost call corruption his father and the worm his mother or his sister, yet is it much better to continue to live amongst a race of degenerates where all decent standards are swept away by a lot of loutish youths who seem to love to litter the streets with their filth and turn the fairest parts of the city into slums? Is it worth living in a life like that? Yet, life is dear, even if it is far from sweet. What hope is there anyway in the grave? Who can see any hope for me, he asks, without expecting to receive, apparently, any reassuring answer. But you see, the essence of Job's misery is not its utter hopelessness. Because if the scene were utterly black and there was no hope, he could probably have laid down and died. It has been done many times. Men can will to die. No, the essence of his agony is that although absolutely all is against him except his ancient faith, it is that, like a divine toothache which nags on at his soul and makes him want to know why there is such a huge gap, such a grand canyon of a gap between God as he knew him and this awful being who has deliberately plunged him in the mire and in the muck. And so far from having any mercy on him, this monster God seems to have inspired practically a whole generation to revile him. But what they don't seem to understand, and I hope we do, is that Job is the only one on the horizon in this book who really takes evil seriously. He takes it seriously and wants to get at the back of it. It is his hatred of that which has laid him so low that drives him on, and he wants an understanding, he wants an explanation of it. And you see, when it is revealed to him ultimately, as it will be at the end of the book, that despite evil's appalling virulence and utter obnoxiousness, evil is yet under the perfect control of the good God. He is, we are sure, perfectly good and has all evil under his control. And when Job sees that, I believe he is perfectly willing that evil should be permitted to do its own strange, hidden work in order. Yes, I believe Job at last, as an old man, with a new family and new possessions and a new health and strength, would have said, yes, when I see what God is doing, what God is using evil to do in his men, in his saints, I am willing that he should do his own strange, hidden work in order to polish the saints. And thus, this is what all this book is about. Make no mistake about that. It is all about polishing saints. And I want to say respectfully to you tonight that if you are against that, then you won't like the book of Job. For that's what it's about. And I would even dare to go on to say you won't want to go to heaven. Which would be strange, of course, for a Christian, wouldn't it? Christians should be homesick for that place, heaven. But I'll tell you what the opening ceremonies in heaven, when we all get there who are believers, I'll tell you what the opening ceremonies in heaven, the judgings, will be like a grand Olympic Games. The opening ceremonies are all to do with the degrees to which the saints are found to have been polished down here. It's all to do with how brightly we have been polished down here. And polishing, as you know, has everything to do with friction. Hasn't it? Friction.